Hi, I'm Mark Lynch, Director of the Project on Middle East Political Science. Welcome to the Middle East Political Science Podcast. On this week's episode, we talk to Marika Sosnowski. She's a postdoctoral research fellow at the University of Melbourne Law School, and she's also a research associate with GIGA in Hamburg. And she's the author of the brand new book, Redefining Ceasefires, Wartime Order and State Building in Syria, published by Cambridge University Press. Marika, thank you so much for joining us.
It's a pleasure, Mark. Thank you for having me here.
So I've been watching this book evolve over the years, and it's really great to see it out now. And why don't you tell us a little bit about it? And you know, what were you trying to accomplish with it? Why did you write it?
Sure. Well, first of all, just because I'm in Australia now, I just want to acknowledge that I'm on Wurundjeri lands. I think that's really important, given that I work on conflict and obviously conflict, or conflict at least, is ongoing here in Australia to do with our First Nations people. And obviously the book is about the revolution and subsequent civil war in Syria. So I feel like it's really important to acknowledge the ongoing violence that's happening there. So this book really, I guess it's about two things. The first question I wanted to ask and answer with the book is basically, what is a ceasefire, and broaden out kind of conventional conceptions about what a ceasefire actually is. Conventionally, a ceasefire has been thought of basically as a halt in armed violence, basically of some form or another, or an agreement that kind of holds violence for a period of time. The book kind of tries to explode that definition a little bit and broaden it right out a lot more, and say that actually ceasefire is rarely only just ceasefire. They do a lot more things. Mm-hmm. And that's basically the second question that the book seeks to answer, is what areas do ceasefires actually affect? And it turns out there's actually a range of things, areas including rebel governance, citizenship and property rights, all these types of things that ceasefires can affect.
Right. So let's before we get into the definitions of ceasefires, let's talk about kind of the case and the context and everything. So this is about Syria after 2011. Tell us a little bit about, you know, why is this a good case for talking about ceasefires and wartime order?
So my interest in Syria started a long time ago. I traveled there quite a bit before 2011. I haven't been able to travel back there since, unfortunately, like many scholars. Basically, the idea for the book came about because in 2013, I was involved in an international development project that aimed to support what was then called the moderate Syrian opposition, develop local governance structures in the areas that had fallen outside regime control. That was sort of things like local councils, courts, policing services, things like that. And during that project, we talked to Syrians, and we'd say, in a nutshell, how are these projects going for you in your different communities? And they would say, look, you know, more or less they're going well until Assad's warplanes come over and bomb us, basically. And then once the bombs started falling, everything would fall apart. So that basically got me thinking that then if there was a ceasefire for a period of time, how would these rebel governance, what were kind of then conceptualized as rebel governance institutions in the literature, how would they then develop further if there was a ceasefire? And that was basically the basic presumption or idea that spurred then the research that became the book. And obviously, you know, as is the case with most of these projects, of course, that was a good idea in practice. And I think Zachariah Manpilli, particularly from Sri Lanka, kind of had that basic idea, which is logical, that if there was a ceasefire, rebel governance institutions would have the ability to develop further, which seems super logical. But then when I started to get into the cases of ceasefires in Syria in a lot more detail, that wasn't necessarily exactly what happened.
And what's interesting also is that in Syria, just empirically, you see a lot of different kinds of ceasefires over the course of the 10 years, roughly, that the book covers. And so you've got a lot of variation there.
Well, I think that's the thing, Mark. I mean, I think traditionally all these ceasefires would just be considered ceasefires, right? I mean, a ceasefire is a ceasefire is a ceasefire, kind of traditionally, conventionally thought about. But yeah, again, what I try to do in the book is say, actually, these are different types of ceasefires that are happening here, and try to make a typology of them where we start to think about them in different ways, and that they have these different agreements have different characteristics that then have different consequences, basically.
It seems like the really big kind of empirical divide is between kind of the top-down attempts, Kofi Annan and Lakhdar Brahimi, and like those kind of failed efforts, and then kind of the post-2015 efforts that were kind of these local agreements. Those seem to be really different in terms of how you approach them.
Possibly. I mean, look, we could look at, I don't look at things like it's a sort of success or failure,
right,
or sort of, I don't look at things in that regard, because if we looked at, say, the de-escalation zone agreements, which could be said to be a bit of a top-down process as well in terms of an agreement actually by Russia, Iran and Turkey,
mm-hmm.
about the territory of Syria, that, I mean, kind of is holding in some way, shape or form, or was quite successful, you know, if you were Russia and all the regime, sadly. So I don't want to look at things like that. It's more about how these different agreements, whether they be negotiated by local actors or by top down, by state actors or whoever, I think what I'm trying to say is that the effects of these ceasefires, no matter who negotiates them, it can be felt across all those levels, basically. So even the top-down ones have very local implications, and also vice versa.
No, absolutely. And so one of the things which is interesting then in kind of the theory part of the book is the way you attempt to then build out what actually happens during a ceasefire. It's not just rearming, resting, and repositioning, but you actually go into a lot of detail about like the different things that the state and the non-state actors are trying to do during these ceasefires, what they're trying to produce.
That's what I try and do. I mean, it's obviously very, you know, it's hard to draw causal connections between the ceasefire and all these things. So I do that to the best of my ability in terms of the interviews and the field work that I've done and things like that. And obviously using a bunch of different literature as well. Yeah, and basically, look, the conclusions are there's a lot of different effects. If we want to go into specific examples, for example, the first sort of empirical chapter of the book looks at the effects of the 2016, what was called the cessation of hostilities, on rebel governance or local governance institutions in the south of Syria, in Daraa governorate specifically. And it finds a lot of different things. I mean, first of all, it totally dismisses my original assumption that, you know, a ceasefire would enable rebel governance institutions to develop better and further. That's not necessarily the case, or it can be the case maybe for some institutions and at some time. It has a lot to do with personal dynamics of different like community leaders, for example. It also is really interesting in terms of that ceasefire particularly. It did actually halt violence for a period of time in the south, which was really interesting. But then what it did do was it halted kind of large-scale violence, but the violence in that area actually morphed then to become much more targeted assassinations at local civilian leaders or rebel leaders, which then had a kind of destabilizing effect on rebel governance initiatives as well. I mean, I use the term rebel governance in the title, but actually I think it's more local governance. If we think of rebel governance as just being groups, then it's actually much more than that. There was a lot of civil institutions as well in terms of courts and local councils that you know, were affiliated with armed groups but not necessarily run by them. So many, many dynamics, including violence, that were affected by the ceasefire, but not just.
And you conceptualize this in terms of wartime orders, which I think is a very useful concept for thinking about what's happening in that interim. It's not just war and peace. There's, you know, this is something which is a much broader process.
That obviously taking that term from people like Sethis Kalivas, who's written a lot about violence and order, and then people like Paul Sandiland and Anna Ahojona, who are kind of using very similar terms, if not the same. I think it's a much more useful term. Well, we tend to think about ceasefires as kind of this step towards peace. And peace is just, I guess, for me and a lot of other sort of more critical scholars, it's quite a problematic term because and like I mentioned, I guess with our own history in Australia in terms of, violence against Indigenous people, where does that where I'm sure a lot of Indigenous people here don't see life being peaceful necessarily. So I guess peace is a bit problematic. So this idea of order that then is constantly being negotiated, and that kind of plays into the state building elements that I talk about as well. And that's a nod to scholars like Christian Lund and Tobias Hagman and Didier Pekelad, who talk about negotiating statehood, and that the elements of the state are in constant flux and can be negotiated. And what I'm trying to say in the book is that ceasefires provide a sort of a moment of order where those elements of the state, a particularly a sort of pregnant moment of opportunity where those moments can be negotiated during wartime, I
And a
guess. And
particular
that's not
configuration of
necessarily.
power, I think is the way you phrase it. A particular configuration of power in.
That's right. So basically, it provides an opportunity for these actors that know the terrain of their own communities or the terrain of their own countries really well, or international actors to renegotiate that space, basically in the order that the ceasefire creates.
And those orders, they vary quite a bit. It's highly localized. So you're not telling like a grand master narrative about this is what happens to Syria during ceasefires, but rather a much more nuanced story. This is what happens in the south. This is what happens in Idlib. This is what happens in kind of the various places where the configurations of power are different.
I think that's, yeah, look, that's definitely what I'm saying in the book, and it's definitely a call for more in-depth analysis of cases, during wartime. I mean, I think as scholars and practitioners, we've known that for a while. We can't generalize always or necessarily from one case to the other. Yet, I think it's that sort of forever paradox. I mean, there are things that we can take from different cases, and I think that are applicable in a broad sense to other cases. And I hope and I think some of the findings from the book are relevant to different cases like Gaza and Ukraine, Sudan, things that we're seeing happening now. When I've been asked to speak about them in the media, for example, I find that a lot of those findings from Syria, like the sort of coercive power of ceasefires, or not necessarily, we tend to think of conventionally ceasefires as being very positive and humanitarian, and that we want a ceasefire for Gaza, right? That's what everyone is calling for, and I'm not calling for that. I definitely am, but I also think we have to be aware that ceasefires are still the least worst option potentially, and that there's a lot of bad things that a ceasefire can contain, for example. And I mean, just one example on that from Gaza recent, I mean, in the previous months, I mean, we saw under the guise of what I would call a ceasefire, it was an agreement to stop violence for a period of time or to change that violence. I mean, we saw the establishment of a humanitarian corridor that, directed people from the north of Gaza to the south of the country. But of course, that corridor in and of itself wasn't a safe route, and that corridor itself, in its creation, was violent in that it displaced people from their homes and things like that. So I think this idea that ceasefires are always a positive and humanitarian thing is a bit naive and misguided. I'm not necessarily saying that they're that bad, but I think that the least worst option is probably a good way to look at them.
But also that ceasefires are going to be productive of certain types of different political orders, which might or might not be better. I mean, you really get into that when you're talking about For example, and this is getting a little ahead of ourselves, but like the reconciliation agreements, which end up, really turning out quite badly for many of the people who signed on to them.
Completely. Like I feel very strongly about the reconciliation agreements that would be, that are basically local ceasefires in the Syrian context. And if we look at them from a traditional viewpoint that is a ceasefire successful if it stops violence, then reconciliation agreements are super successful. Like they completely stop violence in the communities where they were imposed. But effectively, in an article I've written on the topic that I've called, and I think in the book too, I call them strangle contracts. I mean, they're basically ceasefire agreements that different communities in Syria were forced into signing through besiege and bombardment by the regime and Russia. And at the end, they had little choice other than to sign these agreements if they wanted to survive. And so, yeah, I mean, if we look at these agreements in the conventional way, they would be seen as extremely positive because they stopped violence, but then they were agreed to under coercion, so they were violent in their very sort of nature. And then the effects of these ceasefire agreements were effectively to reconfigure the property and the citizenship rights of these people from these communities in terms of permanent displacement for a lot, not all, but a lot of people from these communities like Daraya and Mawardamiya and different communities around Syria.
It's a different form of the reassertion of state power.
Yeah, very violent one, but under the guise, I mean, ironically called reconciliation agreement as well, which has a ring to it that is something positive, right? If you just took that on face value, you would think, oh, that sounds actually quite nice and positive.
But not so much. L let's
Not at
um
all.
let's get back just briefly, because you do spend quite a bit of time on this in the book, in terms of theorizing ceasefires. And so you look really closely at the actual text of ceasefire agreements, both in Syria and kind of more broadly, more globally speaking. Why? What is the value of looking at the text? What do we learn from these? And why is that so key to your method?
So I read a lot of ceasefire agreements. So I create in the book for the sort of the embryonic theory that I come up with, which is a two-square typology of ceasefires along two axes. So one is the text of the agreement, and one is the sort of power disparity between the parties to the agreement. I read a lot of ceasefire agreements, which I don't know if anyone's ever read, actually read that many ceasefire agreements, because they're super interesting documents. I read probably 200, 300, 400 ceasefire agreements. So the idea is that actually the text is important because the parties to the ceasefire agreement would not invest time. The text is what matters, right? I mean, that's all we've got in terms of the agreement. And by text, it can also, obviously, we have oral ceasefire agreements, many. They're not included in the typology, but I think my suspicion is that the typology probably holds for oral agreements as well. But basically, they're a textual version, whether in oral or written form, that's agreed upon by the party. So I guess the idea behind using the text is that because there is diversity in the text of these agreements, the parties invest time into negotiating that text in a specific way, and that's for particular reasons, self-interested reasons, basically.
You kind of learn what they value.
Exactly.
And I think the way you break it down in your 2x2 is either they're vague or they're specific.
Exactly. Yeah, that's the basic structure of it. So either they're a very vague text or they're a very specific text. So I'll give you a few examples. Like there's a agreement from Swat Valley that's like got, I think, 10 terms. It's in the book, and we can bring it up if you like. But it's like the terms are super vague. Like, the Taliban will commit to doing XYZ, which, shutting hairdressers or shutting, I don't know. It's super vague. Whereas, something like a reconciliation agreement in Syria that we were just talking about, or even agreements in Sri Lanka used during the war with the Tamil Tigers, they were really specific in terms of, or even the de-escalation zones in Syria, they're much more specific in terms of they specify roads, they specify how many military checkpoints are going where demobilization has to happen, how many meters apart the troops are going to be from each other. So there's quite a kind of fundamental difference between thinking about something, an agreement that has got these really specific terms, than the agreement in the Swat Valley, for example, to do
Right.
with the Pakistani Taliban. Yeah.
And then the other part of it then is just straightforward power.
Yeah, I wouldn't say actually straightforward power, kind of
Power's never straightforward.
combine it, sort of say it's military and political power, for example. So, I mean, I've been thinking about that a little bit lately in terms of the Gaza war. And, you know, by all accounts, you would think, okay, Israel is much more powerful. Obviously, it is militarily, but Hamas has this political power in terms of the hostages that it still holds. It has political power in terms of world opinion, public opinion, in terms of the way the war has been are prosecuted by Israel. So there is these different sort of power dynamics, and I think it's important
That's a
to
really good point.
include that sort of political dynamics of that power as well.
So that tells you the different types of ceasefires. So in a second, I want to go to Syria and see how this plays out in your specific cases. But there's one more thing before, kind of on the theory side, before we go there. Is the way you're talking, you don't only talk about wartime orders, you also talk about kind of state building and the relationships between state-like organizations, citizens, and all of that sort of thing. And as I understand it, you see the ceasefires as a moment where these are being negotiated and renegotiated. Talk about that a little bit in terms of how you see the connection between kind of ceasefires and these kind of state-building moments.
Sure. So state building is obviously this sort of fraught term from, you know, George W. Bush days, and that's not exactly how I use it in the book. It's probably a little bit, I guess it's more broad and dynamic in the sense that I've mentioned in terms of I guess it's more a synonym with something like public authority, but I guess that doesn't have the same ring to it if you're using it in a title of a book, for example. So it's more to do with how, and that's again Christian Lund and these other authors that are talking about how these elements of public authority are in a constant state of negotiation, basically. And I think ceasefires provide a unique opportunity for those different actors to renegotiate their role in those in those areas of public authority in some way, shape, or form.
So at a place like Idlib, for example, you know, this is really looks quite different than it did before the ceasefire.
So before the de-escalation zone agreement. So exactly. And I mean, just things like, if I mean, I don't mention this so much in the book, but it's been subsequent work I've done on legal identity documents, for example. Hayat Tahrir al-Sham and their associated Salvation Government that's now sort of quite in control of Idlib, in various sort of a support from Turkey, that, you know, debated, they're now sort of consolidating control just through one aspect. You know, this is maybe just mention it as it might be an aspect not many people think about, through these identity documentation in terms of issuing life cycle documents like birth, death, and marriage certificates, and kind of forcibly having people obtain these documents and having to give up their Syrian government IDs and things like that. And that's all been a facilitated by the de-escalation zone in the Salvation Government, and Hayat Tahrir al-Sham has been able to consolidate its power over this area. But I guess not, I mean, in the ways you would think. So maybe this is actually more a typical case of the rebel governance consolidation in some ways.
Competitive state building.
Yeah, but interestingly, I mean, this all came about because originally the de-escalation zones specified four areas of Syria, right, that were de-escalated. The south, Eastern Ghouta, and then area in northern Homs. And then very quickly after that agreement, those other areas made either got basically made reconciliation agreements with the regime and reconciled. And then a lot of people through that de-escalation zone agreement were displaced to Idlib as well. So under this combination of the de-escalation zone agreements and the reconciliation agreement. So it's quite a combo of different agreements happening there, and also not necessarily just this consolidation of rebel governance, because that's obviously not what happened in Eastern Ghouta or in
Of
the
course.
south as well.
So we've been speaking with Marika Sosnowski about her new book, Redefining Ceasefires, and we'll be back after the break. We're back with Marika Sosnowski talking about her book, Redefining Ceasefires, Wartime Order and State Building in Syria, just out with Cambridge University Press. So, Marika, we've been talking to this point mostly about the theory, about ceasefires and state building and wartime order and the like. Let's talk about Syria and kind of how your theory plays out in practice. And maybe a good place to start would be with some of the early attempts at getting a ceasefire through UN mediation, the Kofi Annan plan, for example, or even the Arab League or that sort of thing. And how do you analyze or read those, again, you said before you don't like success and failure as metrics. So how do you evaluate those efforts and their effect?
Sure. So with a lot of basically the typology that I've come up with fits most of the major ceasefires, or all the major ceasefires from Syria can every ceasefire theoretically anywhere can fit into this typology. So I don't empirically examine the 2012, I think it is, Kofi Annan plan, but it is in the typology. So for example, the Kofi Annan plan would come under what I've called an interim agreement, and it's because it's a vague text, and it's relatively symmetrical. The power relations are relatively symmetrical at that point in time. So probably one of the few times during the conflict that the power relations between, say, the signatories to that agreement, the regime and the UN slash rebel groups or opposition groups, were in some sort of relative power parity. And I classify it as interim because the text was relatively vague. It didn't really offer any major specifics in terms of what would happen during that ceasefire. But one thing that it did offer, which I think is really interesting about a lot of the ceasefires and how they fit into the typology in this interim, that's just purely a descriptive term, an interim category, is that it's got a monitoring mechanism. So this was the United Nations Syrian mission, UNSMIS. I can't remember what the acronym stands for at this stage, like monitoring mission for Syria or something. Basically it sets up this monitoring mission, which is a sort of a key component of these interim ceasefire agreements. And you see this characteristic across a bunch of different conflict cases. And it sets up this monitoring mission in Syria, as it does in many cases, like Myanmar, the Philippines, bunch of other ones, where basically it doesn't offer any guidance or any specific guidance to this monitoring mission on what sort of its terms are, what it needs to be doing, where it needs to go. It doesn't offer the mechanism much teeth. So it's really from the beginning in Syria, at least in 2012, this monitoring mission is really floundering around. And I guess the agreement itself is used very much more as a kind of optical, especially these interim agreements. So not just this 2012 one, these interim agreements are used very much as kind of optical wins for the parties. Like, look, great, we've come to a ceasefire agreement. But these interim, these sort of monitoring mechanisms they don't really help in any way, and they can actually kind of more pull these monitoring mechanisms as kind of punching bags or balls to kind of pass the buck to in terms of blaming what's going wrong in different conflicts. And you see that
The sort of thing that gives
there.
ceasefires a bad name.
Kind of. I mean, they look kind of good on the surface. Like I said, like the parties can say, look, we've made a ceasefire, aren't we great? Because generally everyone thinks ceasefires are good, but they actually sort of don't, they sort of hide a lot of violence that's actually happening on the ground. For example, during the time of that ceasefire, the Assad regime started to bomb bread lines and civilians in much greater force than it was previously. That was during that ceasefire.
And there's no enforcement mechanism, no way to prevent it, really.
Well, again, the text is not very specific, so it doesn't specify what's to be done in those circumstances were the terms to be broken, for example. Obviously, like we come now into, murky territory of, how does international law, how do agree peace agreements or ceasefires get enforced in the international community? And obviously that's fraught and hard to do. But I think my general thought is that the first step towards enforcement is to have a specific text, because if you don't have a specific text, you've got nothing to enforce in the first place. Like, at least if there's a specific text, people or the international community or individuals can point to that text and say, look, like you've agreed to something specific. Now you have to be held by it. So there's sort of public opinion and political pressure there, or potentially legal pressure. Whereas if there's no text, there's no imperative for that pressure to come.
So then let's turn to some of the later ceasefires, the ones that that turn into things like the reconciliation agreements and that sort of thing. The first empirical case that you really go into in depth is the Daraa case in southern Syria. And tell us a little bit about that one and how it fits your typology and your thinking.
Yeah, sure. So the Daraa one is this one I mentioned briefly in the beginning. So it's this 20, I well, I use Daraa as the case study. It's actually a nationwide cessation of hostilities that happened in 2016. It was signed between sort of Russia and the US on one side and then the regime on the other side. The text, again, like the interim ceasefire I just mentioned, is quite vague in terms of what will happen during this ceasefire. So it's quite aspirational in nature. It doesn't actually include a monitoring mechanism or anything of that regard. But I would say, actually, at this time in 2016, the power disparity between the parties at that stage in the conflict was quite different. So I would say that the regime was much more powerful than it was in, say, 2012, for example. What it could do within Syria was much more, and the opposition was much less powerful at that stage as well. Yeah, it was the text of the ceasefire was very vague. It didn't offer any specific terms. I think, there was a term that, parties will stop fighting. Didn't sort of offer any specifics about how that would come about exactly. There was quite an ironic and kind of comically sad anecdote from a helpline that the US set up for Syrians to call in to report breaches of the ceasefire, that I think the helpline was based in the Gulf or something like that. And Syrians would apparently call and have, Emiratis speaking to them, or, Americans that had learned Arabic as a second language. And the Syrians said they couldn't understand us, basically, or we couldn't understand what they were saying. So it was just a bit sadly farcical in the way it played out. broadly speaking. But then when I looked at how this had played out in the specific case of the South, that was really interesting. And I looked at that in terms of how it affected local governance institutions. And obviously, the South has its own quite specific dynamics. In 2016, it was under rebel governance control by the main sort of Syrian opposition group. Sort of splintered, but under the broad control of the Syrian interim government. And I guess, look, there was lots of different governance initiatives in the South, and the ceasefire, like I mentioned, played into that in various ways, particularly in terms of the targeting of different individuals, both in terms of those targeted assassinations I mentioned, but also in terms of different sheikhs in the different communities were really well versed in how that sort of public authority was happened in their communities. So they saw this sort of notional pause in violence as a time where they could reassert their control over certain areas like the court or like the councils or like humanitarian access or smuggling routes and things like that. So I think those things and looking at these kind of personal dynamics of sheikhs particularly, but also rebel leaders. Now we see that in the work of Abdullah Jabbasini, who's examined the South a lot, and we see how different rebel leaders have renegotiated their position within society as a result of the subsequent reconciliation agreements, which occurred in 2018 as well. So these local actors are just so well versed in how their communities function and where power is located that they're really adept at using the order that the ceasefire creates to renegotiate their position within those kind of power structures, I guess.
And then you go on to show in the next chapter, you start talking about how this plays out differently in a place like Diraya or Homs or kind of places where social balance of power is different. The impact of the reconciliation agreements or the ceasefires ends up being different as well.
Yeah, well, I guess Diraya particularly was subjected to a very harsh besiegement and bombardment. I mean, it's a very famous case within Syria that was sort of,
Complete decimation.
I mean, pretty much so. And Diraya particularly was completely evacuated of all its citizens after the reconciliation agreement was signed. I mean, what was interesting to me, apart from the sort of very coercive nature of these reconciliation agreements, and that's sort of the category of the typology that that I put these reconciliation agreements under, is this category I call coercive agreements. It's these agreements where the power disparity is really great between different parties. So effectively, one party, in this case, the Syrian regime, with the help of Russia, could force the other party into signing the agreement. And in the case of these reconciliation agreements, what was really interesting to me about them is they had this very the terms of the agreement were actually quite specific in that they had a term that related to people in these communities settling their status, basically, and that people had to report to a security, the Syrian security services, in order to settle their status. And it kind of on the surface seems quite benign, but obviously in the Syrian context, nothing where you report to security is in any way benign. So people could either choose to settle their status, which meant reporting to a security agency, or for anyone that was involved in the rebellion in one way, shape, or form. So that's not just armed group people, that's civilian leaders that were involved in local councils, civil society members, even sometimes doctors and lawyers and notable individuals in the community. They knew that they would not be able to settle their status with the regime, because effectively it was a display of loyalty to the regime. So they were forced then to leave the community and be displaced via the green buses, which have become so infamous in the Syrian context to transport a lot of people to Idlib. So forcibly displaced under the terms of the reconciliation agreement. And what I argue is that these agreements then basically reconfigured their citizenship and property rights. So they forfeited the rights to their properties under the terms of these agreements. And now, in many cases, like Diyarbakır and Old Homs, the regime is now reappropriating those properties for redevelopment projects. Stephen Heidemann writes about this really well, which is terrible. And then the citizenship rights, they sort of, because they've been displaced under these agreements, they now have no rights to kind of be a Syrian citizen vis-a-vis the Syrian regime. They're effectively banished from the state, even though technically they're still within the state, although in Idlib now.
And I think all of this like really gets back to your core central point, which is that when the what we're calling ceasefires are actually something, you know, they are these moments that go well beyond simply a pause in the violence, that you're actually looking at these as much bigger and broader social and political processes.
That's completely right. And I mean, look, people that I spoke to, practitioners, you know, that had been working in Afghanistan or in other conflicts, I mean, I don't think the findings necessarily are sort of revolutionary to anyone that's been looking carefully at conflicts for a long time. But I think what they do is they really highlight this conventional way of thinking about ceasefires as just moments that. As these agreements that halt violence for a period of time is just a too simplistic way to think about ceasefires, basically, and that they're doing a lot more than that, and sometimes not even doing that.
Well, and that might be a good way for us to, you know, kind of end with kind of thinking about, you know, the broader implications. We already talked about this a little bit earlier in our conversation, but let's come back to this. It's like if you look at something like Gaza or Ukraine, especially in Gaza, it seems like the moral imperative of a ceasefire is, you know, kind of unimpeachable. I mean, you know, you've got, you know, huge numbers of people are dying and starving to death, and something needs to be done. And yet, you know, one of the ways of reading your text or your book would be to say that actually you really need to think about what kind of political and social order is going to be produced by the type of ceasefire that is created. So, you know, tell us how you think about these sorts of things. Earlier, you mentioned Ukraine, you mentioned Sudan, now you mentioned Gaza. You know, kind of what are the big takeaways for the book? What should people be paying attention to as they think about the need for a ceasefire in these kinds of cases?
I think you've summed it up really well, Mark. I think, look, and it's not, I guess that's where I feel a little bit conflicted because I obviously support a ceasefire in Gaza immensely, but I also have, because of all this research I've done on ceasefires, I am wary of a ceasefire being this massive panacea to everyone's problems. I mean, I already mentioned this sort of idea of the safe zones or the safe corridors not being safe. I mean, they were specific terms of a previous ceasefire agreement. So I guess the big takeaway is, I guess, to definitely, like, but basically, in a nutshell, ceasefires are the least worst option. And we shouldn't forget that. They're still better than what we've got currently, in the case of Gaza particularly, but they're no kind of amazing magic wand that's going to obviously fix, particularly in the Gaza case, everyone's problems. Or in Syria, we've seen that already. Likewise, I would say is the case in Ukraine and other places like that. So I guess I would be advocating that we look as scholars, as practitioners, as conflict negotiators, we look really carefully at what those terms of the ceasefire are going to be so that we can, I mean, just most basically, so that we can hold the parties to these agreements to account at least at some level for what they agree to in terms of the ceasefire. In the Gaza context, just going a little bit further on that, I've been, you know, particularly worried that there'll be some terminology there around that kind of hides some form of permanent displacement, whether that's to Egypt or whether that's just to the south for people from the north. So that's obviously a very negative consequence of a ceasefire agreement, in my opinion. So yeah, I guess I'm just, I guess while advocating for a ceasefire, I'm cautioning against being wholly optimistic about what a ceasefire can provide.
I mean, that's one of the big takeaways of the Syrian case, right? Is that, ceasefire was something many people really wanted because of the absolute manifest horror of the war. And yet, as you document, the impact of that, it might have brought about, kind of a reduction in violence, but it also really did have all of these quite negative transformative effects on Syrians.
And I think, look, I mean, the Syrian case, you asked earlier about why the Syrian case was so interesting and relevant. And I think, sadly, I mean, that's one of the a big reason why it is so relevant, because so many of these other states and different actors have learnt so that so much horror can be unleashed on civilians. With no consequences. And that's basically a direct result of what happened during the Syrian civil war.
So now you've written this book, and you've kind of grappled with all of these like quite complex problems in Syria. Do you have any thoughts about this in terms of kind of the research process and the journey that you took going from that original idea in 2013 to where you ended up?
Sure. I mean, that's a really nice question, because I think it's great as a scholar to be able to reflect on, things that went right, things that went wrong, what you might feel comfortable with, how things went, what you would potentially do differently next time. I definitely think, I interviewed over, I think, nearly 90 people for the book. I did a lot of field work in sort of neighboring countries to Syria, and in other places where Syrians were located and experts were located. I think I regret not interviewing more women and including more women scholars, citing more female scholars as part of the book. That's just that was just an oversight from me in terms of my career. I think at that time and my knowledge, I think the book would have been improved by having a more diverse range of viewpoints from females as well, even though obviously in the context that I was talking about, a lot of the negotiators were men. A lot of the people that negotiated ceasefires locally were men, or a lot of the community leaders were men. But I think there was probably still people that I could seek out to kind of broaden that view a little bit. Also in my current work, which is sort of delving more, I guess, in different ways. I've been working on the issue of legal identity for a long time now, and now just beginning a new project which looks at kind of the problematization of this idea of a post-war environment and what happens in this presumably post-war environment. And I think for me, I feel like a lot of the interviews I did, basically, I think I would like to work personally just in a little bit more of an ethnographic and a sort of in-depth way with interviewees or people. Not that I feel like the interviews that I did were extractive, but I think that I'm not comfortable now as a scholar with how I did those interviews. I wouldn't do them in the same way again, just to honor the experiences of people and their knowledge. Yeah, and not that that was wrong previously or bad. I just having reflected on that, I think I would do that different, and I am trying to work towards doing that differently now, and to honor the people, honor the knowledge of different people in a much more in-depth, personal way. I think I feel kind of strongly about that.
Really interesting. Well, I'm looking forward to seeing what the next project might end up turning into. We've been speaking to Marika Sosnowski about her book, Redefining Ceasefires. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, Mark, and thank you to you for all your amazing leadership in our great space of Middle East studies. It's very much appreciated by me, and I'm sure many, many other scholars.
Thank you.